I'm Bethany.
And I'm Joel.
And this is Sunday School Cinema. Hooray!
We're doing a very Sunday School movie this week. It is very much the kind of thing that would maybe be shown in, you know, the thing of like, I never experienced this because we were homeschooled, but the thing of like the tired teacher puts on a movie for the day instead of actually teaching history or whatever. This is the Sunday School, tired Sunday School teacher version of that.
Assuming you had 2 hours of Sunday School, or maybe you watch it in parts, I don't know. But yeah, so we watched Luther, a film made by Lutherans, as it proudly, the Thrivent Lutheran Foundation or something, as it proudly says at the beginning. I have to say that the most fascinating thing that came out of this movie for me was that Morgan had no idea who Martin Luther was.
Well, see, I was going to say we might want to open with a little bit of an explanation of the historical context, because I imagine a lot of people don't. And, you know, they hear, I think most people these days probably hear Martin Luther and think we're talking about Martin Luther King. So...
Like, yes, I understand that, like, but, like, this, like, you cannot deny that Martin Luther was, like, an absolute, like, the split of the church was a hugely, like, that's not just church history, that's, like, European history.
Yeah, but I think it's something that most people aren't, even a lot of Christians aren't particularly aware of, I think. Like, we were just nerds, like, we knew about all this stuff, but a lot of people don't, and particularly people who, I mean... Not, I don't know how many people have studied European history back to the 1500s, you know, like, I don't think it's that well known, at least in the U.S.
Okay, well, Martin Luther is the reason we have more than just Catholic Church, is basically what it comes down to.
Well, Catholic and Orthodox both existed at the time, but yeah, he was a Catholic priest who objected to some of the Catholic doctrines and started writing... Is putting forward some of his, well, I guess I would say his own ideas. He would not describe it that way, but his whole thing was basically that we should only be getting Christian doctrine from the Bible rather than he rejected the idea of like priests and the Pope being able to add to Christian doctrine, I guess, the Pope specifically.
Well, and also the... He was bothered by the fact that, like, at this time, like, the Bible was only written in, like, Latin and Greek, so, like, common people couldn't even read it, so everything that, and, you know, even, like, the Catholic services and stuff, of course, were still being done exclusively in Latin, so, like, people didn't necessarily know what any of it said, and they were frequently being grifted. I just find it ironic because it's not like evangelicalism doesn't grift people, but like whatever.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong about that, because the standard thing that he is most known for is his objection to what were called indulgences, which are not a thing anymore. But what they were was basically the Catholic Church would essentially, they would sell you a certificate that said that you or a relative had been freed from purgatory.
Or got years off of purgatory or something.
Right, depending on how much you donated or what it was for or whatever. So essentially you're buying your way out of hell, like literally buying with cash time off of your sentence, essentially your post-death sentence. And it was a very common practice. It was a big part of how the Catholic Church raised money for construction projects and all kinds of things. And, you know, there's nothing in the Bible that says anything about any of that, but people wouldn't have known that because they couldn't read the Bible. So that's kind of like the main thing that I think that was kind of the beginning of his rebellion, I guess. His rejection of the Catholic Church was his objection to that.
I am curious watching this. One of the things I don't know if Martin Luther, played by Joseph Fiennes in this movie, I don't know if Martin Luther was as naive as the Martin Luther in this movie. That was something I had a lot of questions about.
I'm not sure about that either. A big part of this is that early on he's constantly like, no, everything I'm doing is in line with scripture, and the Pope will understand that. If someone just gives me the opportunity to explain it to him, he will be angry that these things are being done under his banner. It's just these, like, you know, greedy, like, next layer down cardinals and bishops and such who are doing this stuff. that did not turn out to be the case. Pope did not back him, believe it or not.
Well, and I think that to me may have been why I liked this movie so much at the time, because that was something that I was learning. Like, I'm sure I've told you this story before, but like, I really thought at some point that like I remember when I first started like learning more about feminism and like getting more into that, I was like, oh, like this is absolutely in line with the things that we've been taught. They just don't get. And I remember having a conversation with Dad that I really thought he would listen to, which in retrospect is absolutely wild. But I, the man who's been fucking brain poisoned by Rush Limbaugh for the entirety of my life, is going to listen to me now about feminism. The man who is the reason I never heard feminism uttered in our house and only feminazi. But like I remember sitting down being like, Dad, like this is, and you know, our father wasn't like, he ended up landing on the side of that female pastors were okay and stuff. Like, he wasn't as intense as some folks were. And I guess there were some reasons that I might have believed that he would hear me. Largely, I think Dad just always seems like he's listening. And then in actuality, he does not, if it's not something he wants to hear. But like, that I
mean, he enjoys discussing. So like, you know, he'll always listen, but you're probably not going to convince him. He just enjoys the debate.
But I remember making this like passionate plea for, and like really thinking that like once he heard, like he would, because he loved me and he would understand what I was saying and the harm that was being done. He didn't know the harm that was being done. And if I just explained it correctly, that like he would understand and he would be on my side, which was really naive and was not the case. But I was thinking about that. I have no idea if Martin Luther was actually that naive to church politics. It seems hard to believe. But on the other hand, the little I know about Martin Luther was that he was like, he wasn't a dude who like lied easily, or like he just kind of said what he thought for better or worse. So maybe he was. Maybe he was that naive.
Well, and also, you know, keep the it's not like the Pope was on Twitter, see, right? It wasn't like you'd have this direct line to begin, you know, if you had always heard your whole life and you'd dedicated yourself to the priesthood that the Pope was God's representative on earth, then, and you're convinced that this thing being done by some higher ups in the Catholic Church isn't in line with what God would want and what God said in the Bible, then yeah, you're probably going to believe that the Pope can't be in line with these things, right? So I don't know. I think it kind of makes sense, but I don't actually know either what I don't know if anyone knows, I guess, what, you know, I mean, he wrote a lot of stuff. I don't know if he directly addressed that in his writing.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I've never read anything that Martin Luther wrote directly. There's a couple lines in here that are like famous quotes of his, the specific, like, you know, I can do no other one about.
I think I have read the whole 95 Theses at some point, but long time ago. I don't know.
But I mean, the movie is awful. Like, it's so boring. It's all like people dressed in like old timey clothes that look like they came from a local theater company's thing. There's a whole weird like disability inspo thing with a little girl, and well, a disability tragedy thing, I guess, with a little girl, and like it's. God, we saw so many of these types of stories, and I do not think we understood how bad they were.
You know, it's funny, because I had a moment early on in this movie where it was a scene, one of the early scenes when he's on his way to Rome. There's a shot of him on the road, and it like swings around, and you see Rome in front of him, and it is clearly a matte painting. And I had a moment of like, oh. They're going for like this is like the classic Hollywood religious epic look. That's what they're going for. Like, you have these big sets that are clearly cardboard and the matte painting background and like whole big crowds of extras, which is a thing you don't see much these days. And it's like the same music and stuff. And I had a moment of like, okay, maybe like that was not, I certainly never thought of that when I saw it before, and that was not what I was expecting. And I was like, okay, so like maybe it'll work on that level, because I wasn't really expecting much from the movie going into it. And I had a moment of like, maybe I need to like reevaluate what I'm expecting here. Maybe this movie will actually work on the level of like the like classic Hollywood biblical historical epic. But it doesn't. I mean, it's it definitely does not. But they even had they brought in a couple of like sort of surprisingly like big name. Alfred Molina shows up in this. Peter Ustinov, who he was in all of those like classic Hollywood historical epic, like that was. So you know, I think that I may have been correct. That was what they were going for, but I mean, it didn't work out.
To be fair, those big Hollywood epics cost a lot of money, and this clearly did not.
Right, and that is part of it. Like they may have been using sort of like some of the same styles of filmmaking, but they clearly didn't have the same kind of finances behind it, or you know, creative minds.
I mean, this was Peter Ustinov's last movie, unfortunately.
Yeah, although he's enjoyable in it. Like he's kind of fun.
Yeah, I mean he is a good time. I was really struck watching this by like being able to look back while watching it and remembering some of these lines having like a really strong impact on me when I was young, and now just being like, I don't care about any of this. Like there's nothing about this. Like I am sort of curious about the political like repercussions of Luther's actions, which apparently ended with a lot of people dead, which I very specifically remember the dad did not know, which is fucking wild. I would like to say our father reads a lot of church history and it is wild to me that he would simply not know that there was like, because of course there was a revolution. Like, I mean, functionally it was Luther may or may not have thought that he was just going along with what God wanted and whatever, and was a pacifist, I guess, and like whatever, like all of that may have been true. But the fact of the matter is that he was removing power from the church and handing it to the people who were fucking pissed when they realized. And like, of course there was fighting and all of these things. I just, yeah, I don't know.
So I just did, you know, the cursory like Wikipedia research, but from my, he wasn't a pacifist, but he was opposed to religious wars. Is my understanding. So like there's brief mention in this movie of the fact that the Turkish Empire is like in the process of invading the eastern border of the Roman, you know, the territory controlled by the Catholics, and that was a very real historical thing that was happening in Luther's lifetime, and apparently he was very much against the church being in charge of a war against the Muslims, but he was fine with the German government doing it. He didn't think it should be a religious thing.
That tracks. I like, it is one of those things where I do feel like Martin Luther is, for better or worse, and probably for worse, who knows, like such a giant figure in history. And they definitely had to clean him up for this. Like because this is like a PG rated movie that you could watch in Sunday school. And like Martin Luther, the little that I know about him was like very crass and very like sort of bombastic sort of person. I don't know that Joseph Fiennes was a great choice to play him in a lot of
ways. I mean, you know, it's the thing that happens a lot with historical biopics is that Joseph Fiennes is a lot sexier than Martin Luther actually was. Like there's a lot of like portraits and stuff that you can find of Martin Luther, and the first word that comes to mind to me to describe him is lumpy. If you look up any image of him, I think you'll see what I mean. Definitely not as attractive as Joseph Fiennes.
But Joseph Fiennes is also doing fucking nothing here for the most part. Like Morgan did not realize who it was and was like, this person is awful. And I was like, well, I mean, it was a name. And Morgan was like, this was a name? And I'm like, it's Ray Fiennes' brother. I mean, and he is the lesser Fiennes, I feel like.
Yeah, unquestionably. That's not even to fault him. Like Ray Fiennes is one of the true greats. So, you know, what are the odds that he would live up to his older brother's acting reputation? But yeah, he's clearly the lesser talent, I guess.
But there's a lot in here about Luther like wrestling with Satan sort of thing, which I believe is something that he talked about a lot. I remember
it goes back over and over to these scenes of him like arguing out loud with, and it really just kind of gives off schizophrenia vibes more than anything else. Like and it's not particularly well. I mean, it'd be really hard to deliver that stuff convincingly, but he definitely doesn't hit the mark.
Yep. And I mean, I don't know. He does his stuff. He has friends and enemies and friends who like, you know, I mean, that's the other thing in terms of his naivete, is not just that, like, the Pope is going to hear this and is going to be on his side, but the idea that he somehow, like, doesn't understand that what he's doing is functionally, like, bringing cultural revolution, and that people will understand that and will take advantage of that. And I don't even necessarily think in a bad way all the time, but, like, he is somehow offended that people, like, in a way, I suppose there is, like, a level of, oh, I don't know how to articulate this well, but, like, thinking about it in terms of this thing of, like, he is viewing this as this, like, holy war, like, this, like, spiritual battle or whatever, and is somehow just completely, like, he's not really fighting for, like, social change per se. He's fighting for God, which I do think evangelicals do still do, of, like, you know, we're fighting over this theological stuff, but we don't actually want to work on state stuff to, like, make people not go hungry or that sort of thing.
I think most people at the time wouldn't really have recognized that distinction. At least they would have seen them as a lot more interconnected. And if anything carries through to this day, would have seen the correction of social ills as a much lesser priority, because, you know, you're only alive for, at the time, 25 years, you know, 40 years, whatever. And, you know, eternity's forever. So that's the more important thing.
No, I mean, I don't disagree with you, but I think that that some of what we don't see, and I could, like I said, I've never read a biography of Luther. I probably would if it wasn't, like, too dry to deal with, but like, is that he, you know, he, like, I agree with you. I think that the fixing of social ills is seen as, like, less critical than the saving of people's souls. But I did, like, sense this narrative going through. And it's hard to say, because I actually don't think that this movie necessarily reflects that much of what happened. I know that the historical inaccuracies part on Wikipedia is pretty long. I don't know that. But, like, thinking about it less as, like, inspired by a historical thing, but, like, as a story being told now by kids, by Christians, that when I think of it, or, you know, not now, but 20 years ago, that when I think about, like, what is the story they are trying to tell, it still is consistently this thing of, like, you know, that people starving to death or people, like, having all of these things, like, it's unjust, and I feel like it's supposed to, like, that several scenes with Luther are supposed to sort of, like, you know, reminisce for us, particularly the indulgences of, like, Jesus, like, turning tables over in the temple sort of thing. But, like, we don't ever see him actually do that much to, like, help people in the here and now. And so whether or not that was true then, when you think of, like, what is the story they want to tell now? And the story they want to tell now is that it's so amazing that we get to trust God through faith and go to heaven, but, like, still makes no meaningful answer or has any interest in, like, how to actually help people. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's some very, I guess, sort of cursory stuff, like you mentioned the sort of disability inspiration, whatever. There's a whole sort of subplot with this woman who has a disabled daughter that essentially is homeless, lives in the woods with her daughter and sells firewood to make money. And a big, you know, he has this whole, a big part of his objection to indulgences was that they were essentially robbing the poor of money that they needed, because the poor were spending money they didn't have because they believed it would get them time out of hell, or, you know, save their infant who died from having to suffer in hell or whatever. So I think part of his objection to indulgences was that it took away from actually needed charity to people who really needed it. So there's kind of, like, there's a little bit of a nod to that. It's talked about a little bit in the movie, but he definitely seems to kind of lose track of that as the movie goes on. I felt like his character became more and more of a jerk as the movie went on, which seemed like a weird choice, but I mean, he probably was kind of a jerk, so maybe it's just accurate, but it seemed like a weird choice. There's no point in the movie, to me at least, where he feels like an aspirational figure. Like, I don't know if they were going for in that regard exactly, but it never came off that way to me.
I mean, yes-ish, but, like, also think of every, like, aspirational figure that Christian... Like, I mean, you know, I feel like we're supposed to be, like, drawing these comparisons to some level if you're in this to, like, Paul, who was a fucking asshole, or, like, and realistically, as far as I can tell, Luther was kind of a fucking asshole. But, like, we're supposed to, like, admire that? Like, it's some sort of, like, very manly... I don't know. I mean, you know, I think of Marcel and Mark Driscoll, a lot of that kind of stuff, and I think there's a lot of over like he really liked Luther. I'm sure that would shock you.
Well, Luther is kind of a hero of a very specific type of modern American Protestant, like, because he's seen as this sort of rebel, and I think a lot of people would probably tell you that, you know, the church today is overdue for another Martin Luther figure who's going to come along and shake everything up. And, you know, I think a lot of people sort of maybe aspire to be that. Not that it's, I don't think it's worked out very well for anyone, but he is very, I mean, you know, I spent 2 years at Bible college and people talk about Martin Luther as... people definitely talked about him as an aspirational figure. And it was kind of funny, actually. There's a scene in this movie where he is literally at Bible college. He's studying for his doctorate in theology. And there's a scene in a classroom where he's arguing with a professor about the specific translation of a specific verse and how that relates to Catholic theology that only Catholics can be saved. And I was like, I swear I had a conversation, like, I lived through this, this exact, like it's like a thing for him where it's like this sort of awakening of like, wait, that's what the church is teaching and they're basing it on this? But that doesn't make, like, I had so many moments like that sitting in classes at Bible college, which, you know, for me, ended up with me leaving the whole thing behind, not trying to remake it, but... It definitely struck me watching it this time.
No, and I think that, I mean, I'm going to assume, like, I don't think I was ever, like, head over heels in love with this movie, but I think I did like the movie a lot more. And I think that it was, again, you know, going back to, like, where we were at that point, feeling like we were seeing all of these things that were wrong in the church and, you know, people weren't hearing us or whatever. And so I suspect there was a, and the other, you know, Luther also got married to a former nun, which was a huge deal, like, you know, in terms of like that it was okay for like religious leaders to get married and have children and all of these things. I think there are letters between the two of them that we still have. you know, the thing I remember the most about the conversation after this movie was my father saying that Luther was a complicated and problematic figure in some ways. And one of the ways being that he was wildly fucking anti-Semitic, but...
The movie does not address that at all. I think sort of his actual writings about that and stuff mostly came after the period portrayed in the movie. But yeah, the movie does not address that the least bit at all.
So Dad brought this up and was like, but... It's kind of like he didn't say, but like, it's okay, though, but like, it's sort of understandable, though, because essentially he was like, Luther was so excited to bring the gospel to the Jews. And he was so devastated when they were not fucking interested that he then began to hate Jews. And even at the time, I remember being like, that's a weird excuse. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's true. I think a lot of historians these days see, you know, there's a lot of what Martin Luther did and his I don't think he ever advocated for, like, you know, genocidal policies, but he advocated for expelling Jews from German territory and burning synagogues and all of this stuff. And, you know, I think a lot of, he was in Germany. A lot of there's a lot of lines to be drawn between that and the where Germany ended up going. Yeah, what was I was again my Wikipedia research here was I'm trying to remember what the exact term was that he used. It was basically another version of tough love. Like that was his justification for it. I think sharp mercy. I think that was the term that he used. That, you know, the basically like they're not going to get it if we if we just let them keep living the way they've been living, they're never going to change. So we have to force them into changing their ways or whatever. It's all pretty reprehensible. But it is true that a lot of evangelicals today will point to like, well, but he initially tried to convert the Jews. Like that was his initial idea, was that he wanted to invite them in. He wanted to convert them. And it wasn't until they rejected that he turned on them. And people say that as if that's some kind of an excuse. And it's unsettling.
It is unsettling. And it is also very in line with the way that we haven't watched Amen yet. When we do that one, we will have more of a discussion about what the talk that happened after that movie.
yeah, I think that's our last Holocaust movie that we haven't got to yet. Yeah.
But it's something I think about a lot, because this is how Dad expected us to view people. And in his view, it was like, you know, there's always reasons, like, you know, you want to understand the whole person, and people always think that they're doing the right thing in the moment, and hindsight's 20/20, and we can't judge them based on what we know now, and all of these things. I would like to add that he was not nearly so generous with people who were outside of the space that he understood or believed in. but the thing is that I feel like both you and I actually took quite a lot of that very seriously and did apply it to people outside of the space he believed in, and he didn't love that. But this was a very typical, like, we were never allowed to, like, really, like, wrestle meaningfully with the, like, very dangerous flaws of people in our faith background and such, because, like, that would be dangerous, right? Like, that you're, like, pushing back against, like, God has, you know, the church is full of imperfect people, and we have to give them grace, just like, and it's just one of those things that makes me mad still.
Yeah. What was it? I had something specific about the movie that I was going to come back to, and now I'm forgetting what it was. But did you look into the director's filmography at all? He has kind of an amusing filmography if you take it as a whole.
I did not.
So his name is Eric Till. It looks like he's done mostly like TV movies and stuff. So if you look at his page on Letterboxd, it'll show like his four most rated things, right? One of them is Luther. It's number two. The number one and number three are both like Muppet Christmas specials that I've never heard of. A Muppet Family Christmas and The Christmas Toy. Number four is a TV movie or miniseries about John Wayne Gacy starring Brian Dennehy. has this terrifying cover image is called To Catch a Killer. He has a few other things that I've heard of. There's a Henry Winkler did an American Christmas Carol, which is the thing that I had heard of, but that was him.
The man likes Christmas, apparently.
Well, exactly. He's done several Christmassy things. He did a TV adaptation of Bridge to Terabithia in the 80s, apparently. I don't quite know how he ended up with this role. He also did a movie about Bonhoeffer at one point, who was another sort of idol of a lot of modern evangelicals. He was a German Lutheran, I believe, guy who got involved with the resistance to the Nazis and was involved in an attempt to assassinate Hitler.
And was gay. He was gay. And I never learned that when I was young, but he was gay. Yeah, he was very much gay.
Yeah, the evangelicals don't normally talk about that. His filmography is full of like TV movies and stuff. So I don't know how he ended up getting this one. Maybe he's Lutheran and was like, you know, knew people that were involved in the funding of it or something. But I also don't, I want to know what the story is behind how Alfred Molina ended up in this movie, because he gets this, like, he's fun. He gets this, like, sort of, he gets to play this sort of, like, devilish priest who is, he's essentially, like, the pitch man for indulgences. So he has this whole act where he goes out to speak to the people and is telling them about the fires of hell, and he has this bit where he actually, like, burns his own hand over a torch.
That was very upsetting.
I don't know how often he does this. Like, how often can he do that and still have a functional hand? But he gets very like scenery chewy, and that's probably the most fun that the movie has at any point. And I can kind of see why he would enjoy doing that, but I don't know how he ended up involved in this. It's kind of odd.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, you know, it's not bad in a fun way. It's mostly just kind of boring, and
it's so long. And it's like, it doesn't really have, there isn't like an obvious climax point in the narrative, but there kind of is. And then there's like 40 minutes left in the movie. Like, it comes way too early. And then the movie just feels like it drags on and on and on. Peek behind the curtain here. We got going kind of late today because I usually get up and watch the movie in the morning before coming over to record. And I slept late today. And so I got up and I'm watching it, and I'm about to message Beth to let them know that, like, you know, I'm running a little late or whatever. And I realize I'm only like an hour into the movie. I was like, okay, let's wrap it up. So I'm almost done here. And then I realize I'm like halfway through. It's unforgivably long, honestly. It very much feels like, particularly in the second half, like, you know, the Lutheran financiers of this movie had this series of like, these are the historical moments that we want to hit. So they're just like going through and checking off all these things. It's not the worst thing we've watched for this. It's not like unwatchably offensive or anything like that, but it's just not, if this isn't a subject that you're interested in, I can't imagine why the movie would interest you.
Even if it is, it's not. I feel like there are better ways to engage in that subject. I don't know. I gave it 1 star. I had it at 3.5 previously. It is the Sunday school movie. Like, it is the movie, like, you know, and we watched a bunch of this type of shit when we were younger. And I don't think we were ever like super enamored of most of it then, but we didn't like have the context to understand what bullshit it was.
Yeah, I mean, I think this movie is, it's in terms of like just production value and talent on screen and stuff, it is definitely a few steps ahead of what Christian movies were at the time. I think now Christian movies have, at least in terms of production value, have come a long way. So it maybe hasn't aged well in that regard either, but it definitely looked better than like the, you know, do you remember the Jesus movie that was like, videos of it were always getting passed around churches and stuff? Like, it looks better than that kind of stuff that you would have seen like in Sunday school settings or whatever. But that's such a, I mean, that's an embarrassingly low bar. It's just not a very good movie.
And the only way to watch it is to rent it for like $6 on like Amazon.
Yeah, and it's not even in HD. It's just, which, although having it in standard def may have added, in fact, to the like the historical vibe, old Hollywood vibe. But yeah, I wouldn't recommend it to anyone really.
Same. I can't imagine a reason that I would ever watch it again. So, but we've done it and it's behind us now. Anything else you wanted to say about it?
Nah. I could probably come up with something, but why bother?
Fair enough. Okay. We have 29 movies remaining. So we're chipping away here.
I forgot to pull up the random number generator, so that's what the pause you're hearing is. Hey, what's number 29?
29 is Winterlight, so.
I have, the Bergman movie. I forgot, I didn't remember we watched that for this.
We did. We did, in fact, make our father watch 3 separate Ingmar Bergman movies.
We watched The Seventh Seal, right? Okay, so I've been thinking about that one, and I was kind of looking forward to that one. I did not remember that we watched Winterlight for this, though. That's a bleak one, even by his standards.
Yes, but it was also what, again, I think, I haven't watched it in years. I'm curious to see it again. Yeah. But yeah, so.
I mean, I get why we would have, like, why it would have been on the list to watch or whatever. I just didn't remember that we'd watched it. It is basically the movie First Reformed. The first half of that movie was essentially a remake of Winterlight, which I feel like didn't get talked about much at the time, but it's interesting. I mean, I remember really liking Winterlight, so I'm excited to watch it again. I was not expecting that. Didn't remember it was in here.
Yeah, I'm also curious. I think that that again, some of what happens with some of these movies is that part of the reason I found them so compelling was because I was really like drawn in by those questions at the time, and now that I don't care about those questions, sometimes they're not. But also, Bergman is Bergman, and like, you know.
The plot summary for Winterlight on Letterboxd is: a Swedish pastor fails a loving woman, a suicidal fisherman, and God.
Wow.
Which, I mean, from what I remember, that pretty much sums it up. So that's what we've got. That's what we've got coming next. Should we try to squeeze that one in before Christmas? Get the holiday spirit going on our.
We'll see. We'll see if we can make it. I'm not sure. Anyway, so then watch it. I've been watching a lot of stuff. It's the end of the year. We're at crunch time. Do you want to go first or should I go first?
Why don't you go first? I think I went first last.
Okay, fair enough. The first thing that we watched after last time was that we went back to our Martin Scorsese very slow watching all of them thing with a movie that was like I don't know if it was a TV spot or something that he did. I don't know.
I think it was a thing that he did for a TV network, I think.
And it was called Street Scenes, 1970, and it was at a lot of the like Vietnam War protests sort of thing. It's messy. It's chaotic a lot of the time. Sometimes the sound and stuff. I mean, you know, this is like a YouTube upload sort of thing. It's not like available anywhere. But it was still interesting. And I particularly thought that the way he ended it was extremely fascinating, where the whole like last scene is just a bunch of like these organizers like arguing functionally about like how, you know, is this gonna work, is this not gonna work. Harvey Keitel is one of them. Like, there's all of this like back and forth that I would have watched an hour and a half of just that, because I think it really, and I mean at the time reading about what he thought while he was making it, that he was just so frustrated and like left it on sort of this, but to me I was like, but this is like, I feel like this is the thing that we have somehow forgotten about organizing, is that it is messy as fuck, and like it is, and like people have contradictory opinions and they may both be right in their own ways, and like how do you like, and I found the end part like super fascinating. I don't know. What did
you think? Yeah, I mean I found the whole thing just kind of fascinating. I've always been kind of, you know, interested in like protest movements in general and stuff, so most of it is like sort of on the ground, you know, interviewing people on the street on both sides of the issue. If I remember correctly, there's like a big strike demonstration thing around Wall Street is kind of the first chunk of it. And then there was a march on DC, and then there was this conversation that you're talking about. I think that was kind of the major chunks of it. So most of it is like, you know, we're on the ground during marches and demonstrations and stuff. And I find that stuff really fascinating. So it's kind of a shame actually that I think that it's not more readily available. Although I don't know what the, I don't know. It'd be a weird thing to do like a Blu-ray release of, I think. I don't know what the proper medium for that would be, but it's interesting. It's definitely worth seeking out.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting, and I was glad we watched it. And, you know, some of what I feel like comes up in a lot of these historical things is, man, nothing fucking changes. Like, the same arguments are being made, the same people are saying the same things when they're yelling at them. Like, it's... but I think that there's a real value to that, and a real value to, like, understanding the space that this fits in history, and, like, both that, like, the battles we are fighting are important, and there are, like, you know, hundreds of years of people fighting these battles.
Right, same fight still happening. That is, I think, always an important thing to keep in mind. And, you know, it's interesting to see, like, oh, yeah, the cops were always like this. They just didn't have tanks back then. Like, that kind of stuff. It's definitely worthwhile.
It was definitely very noticeable how much less heavily armed the police were than they were now. But yeah, I mean, it's up on YouTube. It's like an hour or 70 minutes or something. I think it's worth watching. And then later... that day, Morgan and I watched Masculine, Feminine, the Godard one, I think. Yes.
Yeah, I was just trying to remember if I've seen that one. I don't think I have.
It's fine. I don't know. There's some stuff in it, but like, it's mostly about this like impossibly pretentious and obnoxious white boy, who I think is supposed to be pretentious and obnoxious, but it was still a lot to ask.
I mean,
it was still a lot to ask, though, and I was mostly annoyed. Then we watched the Amazon documentary about the Twin Flames universe, which they're interesting to watch in conjunction, but I talked a fair amount about that last time. I was feeling meh and didn't really want to. I'm tired. So anyway, we watched Newsies because which I continue to hold up as probably like there's a handful of movies that in retrospect, when I look back, I realize they were like incredibly radicalizing for me in ways I didn't fully understand at the time. And they're not all what you'd think they would be. But like Newsies is very high on that list.
I haven't seen that movie since I was a very young kid, and I do think about watching it every once in a while because I suspect it would, like, I liked it well enough as a kid, although I wasn't really into musicals as a kid, but I suspect it would, I would have a lot more feelings about it now than I did when I was young.
I think it's kind of a great intro in a lot of ways to like baby's first understanding of, you know, of unions and stuff. And it genuinely made a very strong impact in my brain of the importance of unions and what that looked like. And looking at it now, also seeing like, you know, the way that they show again, like they're I feel like in retrospect that when I first started meaningfully hearing about policemen murdering, attacking, like that there was a part of my brain that was like, yes, that's what they do. Like they don't, like, you know, there's one scene in particular in Newsies where they bring in the police, just watch while they bring in these gangsters to beat the shit out of these like little kids, and then later the police do the beating. And I think I was so obsessed with this movie as a kid. And then, you know, when that, like, as a part of that, they also, like, remove the leader and offer him money and threaten him and whatever, because they know that if one of the, you know, if the leader goes down and the whole movement, like, this is pretty much the playbook. It hasn't changed that much. And yes, it's very, like, simplified. And the songs, I still really enjoy the songs too, but it's very simplified. But it's like, I feel like I watched it at 12. First, and like that was a great time to like see that. Ever After is another one that I think was like way more radicalizing for me than I realized at the time. Anyway, so we watched Newsies, still great. It's up on Disney Plus. If anyone hasn't seen it, you should. And then we watched Les Mis. While Mel was here, I seem to always have like a general itch to watch Les Mis like around November, December sort of time period. I really have run the get. Like initially, when I watched this movie, I was not so sure how I felt about it. And I do think watching it on television helps. The extreme close-ups that are kind of painful in theaters are not as painful when watching it on TV. Anyway, I love Les Mis now, so that's great. I mean, the show is always great. I just mean the Tom Hooper version in particular. We watched Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And then we watched Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn movie called Holiday that I had never seen. I don't know if you've seen that one.
I don't think so, no.
It's kind of, like, Morgan really enjoyed it, but has also almost never seen Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn in much, so I feel like they, like, it's fine. They're great together. We know they're great together. We see that, but, like, the movie itself is, like, eh, it's fine. And then we went to go see Napoleon, which was, this was Sunday afternoon after Thanksgiving weekend. There were so many dads in that theater with their, like, older teenage sons. It was just, like, I really think there were very few femme people in the theater. It was mostly just these men. It's okay. I don't know. It's okay. Joel hasn't seen it yet.
I think I'm going to see it later today, and I'm looking forward to it based on most of what, like, I've heard very mixed things from different people, but I'm kind of excited about it.
I wasn't mad. I watched it. I liked it better than I worried I would like it based on my own tastes. I don't know. I don't know where I land on it fully. Will I watch the 4.5-hour cut or whatever fucking nonsense? Maybe. I don't know.
I mean, it'll probably be better. That's, you know, that's, I think that's sort of what his usual historical epic thing is, that he makes them way too long and then has to cut them down too much. But anyway, you'll hear back next recording what I think.
And then we came home, we watched the new Mike Birbiglia stand-up special, The Old Man in the Pool.
I still haven't watched that. Yeah, I really like him, but I haven't watched it yet.
I also really like him. His last one, I think, was called The New One, where it was about him having a baby. And I loved that one. I thought that one was incredible. This one was good, but not like his best to me. But, you know, I enjoy him. And then I went with Ezra to watch The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes.
I haven't seen it. I'm still kind of on the fence about whether I want to.
It's fine. It looks great, And there are some, and it was way more of a, I mean, it's not a musical, but it was way more musical than I
realized. I was about to say, I've heard that it has like really good original songs in it, which is interesting. That's not something that happens very often, particularly with movies that aren't specifically musicals.
Yes, it does. And there's just no like denying the fact that like Rachel Ziegler is so compelling and magnetic, and her voice is so beautiful, and so we get to hear her sing a lot of very beautiful songs and a cover of the Hanging Tree that it was sort of in the trailer but is in the movie as well in a longer version. All of that was great. The costuming, oh, beautiful costuming, loved the costuming. I have the same questions that I had when I first heard that the book was coming out, or much less when the movie was coming out. It's like, why? Like, why do I care? I feel like if you are going to make a story about sort of the rise of this like supervillain character, like there really needs to be a reason why we're spending so much time focusing on this person. And I'm not sure that they provided that reason, especially because I really thought it was going to be a little more... Well, the kid who played Coriolanus was pretty good. I thought he did a good job. I don't think he had a lot to work with. I was really unclear on Snow's, like where his head was at for a lot of the movie. But it doesn't feel like, and then when I talked to Ezra, who actually read the book, it doesn't feel like there was really, like, he's never not a bad guy. Like, the book is from first person. It's not like he was, like, this much better person who then, like, becomes this evil monster. He's always kind of plotting and scheming. And I'm like, well, then what's the point? I don't understand, like, just, like, sometimes bad men are born and then they get to do a lot of shit. I don't know. I don't really get it. It's set up in three chapters. The first two chapters were pretty zippy. I definitely like had a good time watching. I felt like the third one dragged a little bit. I'm not like mad I saw it. I'm just like a little confused about why it exists to some extent. But it does look beautiful and the costuming is great. And Rachel Ziegler sings a lot. I think she has like five full songs in the movie and they're very beautiful. So, you know. And then Morgan and I watched another cult documentary. You can always tell when I'm like exhausted or depressed because all I want to do is watch true crime, and most specifically cults, but I'll settle for other true crime. HBO Max had a new one called Love Is One, The Cult of Mother God. Which was mostly depressing. It wasn't like, which I understand that probably for most people, most true crime cult stuff is depressing. I don't tend to find it that way. I think that I find a level of like comfort in like the consistency of things. This usually with most cults is like, ah, there's the grifter and whatever. I don't actually think that's what happened here. She was just very sick. I think she had a fucking mental break. She like took ecstasy or something. And you know, it's not common, but it can cause a break if you have like a history, you know, if there's a mental health history in your family, you have like predisposition towards it basically. And essentially she took drugs and became convinced that the world that she saw was, well, on drugs was the actual world and that she was being kept from it in some way. And then she proceeded to just like she gained some followers on YouTube and various things. And she just kind of, she just was like they all started smoking weed as soon as they woke up. Like they're constantly high on things. Most of them are pretty young. She also has like an eating disorder sort of thing that is, some of the girls in the cult are really alarmingly skinny. And I know this because almost everyone who speaks in this documentary is currently a believer, is not someone who left, which is actually unusual for these sorts of things. But she passed. She died. We know that from the very start of the thing. She died of fucking liver failure. She died. They all like fucking, like, surrounded her and fed her endless amounts of colloidal silver. She was literally turning blue by the end. They, like, you know, all of these things. And then she died. And realistically, the only reason why this ended up, like, enough to get, like, a documentary is that they carried her body around for a while, including, like, over several state lines, because they were convinced that she was still alive and she was going to come back. And eventually they ended up in Colorado and, like, the cops got called for a wellness check and they found her like literally like mummified in the bed with Christmas lights on her. And like,
ooh, that's pretty bleak. That's bad.
It is. It's very bleak. And it's one of those things where like they were making quite a bit of money. They were selling a lot of like tinctures and like whatever online. And so they made a fair amount of money. There was sort of a, there's an interesting element of having mostly true believers talk in your documentary. And I can see why, because they think she's like the second coming of Christ. So they think, like, or whatever. So they think that, you know, this is an opportunity for them to get her message out there. And I will give props to the director of this, who doesn't do any sort of gotcha stuff, who doesn't do any, like, it is very clear. She was just like, I'm going to let you talk and you're going to, like, everyone's going to think you're fucking crazy, but, like, I'm not going to, you know, there's no weird snap cuts or like anything like that. Like, she is just letting them tell their story, which is what they want to do. So I felt like okay-ish about that. But, like, it also means that there's a lot of things that they don't go into that much, because they don't, like, they have some awareness of, like, what the weirder shit is and, like, whatever. And there was stuff I did want to know more about. She believed that she had all of these, like, spiritual, like, companions who, like, talked through her sometimes, or other people, or they would send messages to other people. They're mostly dead celebrities, the most famous one being Robin Williams that they kept. I mean, not even the most famous one, but the one they talked about the most. But, like, Elvis is on, they had a whole, like, thing. But also Trump, she was also a Trump person, which is a weird, like, thing, but we don't hear much about that, because, like, so, like, there were a lot of things that I was curious about, but at the same time I was like, this is like 20 people. This was not, I mean, obviously people were buying their shit online and stuff, but in terms of people who are following her, this is not a particularly, like, dangerous, like, cult, I don't think, except to the people who are in it. Like, at one point they went to Hawaii when she was sick, and she, and, like, I think she was really, like, I mean, I think she was so fucking fried at this point that, like, but she became, like, I think she was genuinely convinced. I think she really believed that she was, like, and at some point she, like, came and, like, spoke to a bunch of the Hawaiians and told them she was Pele. Which led to a huge protest, and they were basically chased off the island, and, like, good. But, like, it's just, it was really sad more than anything else, of just, like, it was just, like, such a fucking waste. And now, of course, you know, the handful of them who still remain are still out there doing whatever, but whatever. It was definitely interesting. If you are interested in cult stuff, it is an interesting one, and it is unusual to have the primary viewpoint most of the time be from people inside it. So if that's something that interests you, it's up on Max. Anyway, then this weekend, Eric was up and we watched Alien Cubed. it was terrible. It was very bad. It was awful. And I fucking hated it. So
I've still only watched it once. I remember liking it more than I expected to. But I mean, obviously, there's a lot has been said and written about, you know, that as David Fincher's first movie and studio interference and how he was basically disowned the movie because it wasn't what he wanted it to be and all this stuff. It does have its defenders these days, though.
I just can't get past the fact that Ripley, a character who has, you know, been this, like, incredible female-led sci-fi, partly because initially they wrote it for a man, but doesn't matter. Alien is great.
She's... I think the characters were all written as essentially gender neutral, I believe, with the original screenplay, was my understanding. They were written so they could be cast either way, but...
Either way, it ended up being this incredible, like, female-led sci-fi thing. I think both of the first two, not that this is, like, the end-all be-all, but I think both of the first two passed the Bechdel test, which is very rare, especially for sci-fi movies at this point. And then they were like, what could we do with Ripley? We could bring her to a place where literally the only other female is the alien and constantly threaten her with gang rape for 2 hours. We love that. We love it. We love it. What a phenomenal way to honor this character. And yes, in spite of Fincher, in spite of the, like, studio interference and all of that, I cannot get past the fact that I think Fincher really likes rape in his movies, so I do hold that on him to some extent too. And I just found it so gross and awful. But, you know, we'll watch the fourth one yet. No doubt Joss Whedon will save us all from that.
I mean, he I don't think he actually wrote the fourth one. I think he did, like, a pass on the screenplay or whatever, but I remember nothing at all about the fourth one. Like, I watched I have, like, the box set of all four of them, and I watched through it once, and I hardly remember the third one at all. I don't remember a single moment from the fourth one. So
anyway, then we watched Transformers Rise of the Beasts, because we watched Bumblebee last time. It was fun. It was not as good as Bumblebee, certainly. Also, certainly better than any of the Michael Bay ones. It's silly. It was very goofy and silly, and I genuinely laughed a few times, and it was too long, but overall, not bad.
Real quick, incidentally, I just checked, and I checked my Letterboxd ratings for the third and fourth Alien movies, and I gave them both 1.5 stars, so apparently I'll probably go back to them one of these days, but yeah, I was not a fan.
And then yesterday, this is the only weekend that Morgan and I have this entire month where we are not doing so many things. So we were like, we're just going to watch a stupid amount of catch-up movies. And then, of course, we'll have the whole last week to cut all of that off. But so we started yesterday with They Clone Tyrone. Have you not seen that?
No, it came out during the period where I didn't have Netflix. And, I haven't caught up with it. I'm curious about it, but...
Super fun. It's a really good time. It's really interesting little story. I honestly don't want to say that much about it because I think the less you know going into it, probably the better. But great performance from John Boyega. Really, really great work there. So yeah, I liked it a lot. It was a good day overall, honestly, except that we ended it on Luther. So then we watched Fry Bread Face and Me, which just recently came out on Netflix, which is Joel...
I just heard something about that somewhere recently, and I can't remember where. I had never heard the name before, but I just heard it somewhere a couple days ago.
It is about a 11-year-old Native kid who gets sent to the reservation for the summer to stay with his grandma, Navajo, Dene. And it's like 80 minutes, and his cousin is also out there. It's really lovely. It's a really lovely, it's written, directed by Natives. I didn't get a chance to look up whether or not it was based on his actual experiences. It feels like it could be. Really, really beautiful, lovely movie. I super recommend it. People should check it out. And then we watched Rustin, also on Netflix. Have you heard anything about this one?
Oh, that's the one about, civil rights guy with, is it Coleman Domingo? I've heard he's really great in it. That kind of biopic doesn't usually interest me that much these days, but I mean,
same, but I honestly would recommend this one. I think it has some of the, visually, I think it has some of similar, the sort of flatness that you associate with most biopics, honestly. Yes, the lead character, the lead role is incredible. Bayard Rustin was his name. And I do think, one, it is a biopic that only focuses on a specific period of his life, which is always the way
that's
to go.
Helpful, yeah.
We don't see his childhood or anything like that. It is specifically focused on his work bringing, this huge march to Washington, D.C., and he was gay. And so there was a lot of back and forth about this. There was a lot of the opposite side trying to use. But he was an incredibly charismatic and he was a guy who got things done. He was really good at this work. And so they were finding ways to have him work with them anyway. And I think that one of the things I do like about this biopic that I have not necessarily seen, I mean, honestly, bringing back to sort of the street scenes and stuff, is that it shows a lot of the messiness and the infighting and because his existence ends up causing these things that he's not willing to pretend that he's straight for. And that leads him to a lot of, and it's just, it's really, I really liked it. I thought it was a really cool, and I looked it up later and it looks like at least all of the basic facts are pretty much on point. So that's nice.
There was basically, it was just him and James Baldwin were really the only openly gay people with sort of leadership roles in the civil rights movement, right? And I know a lot about James Baldwin because I find him really fascinating, but I don't know anything about this guy, so I'm curious.
Yeah, I think it's worth watching. It's an hour 45 minutes. I've been thinking a lot lately both about sort of the way that major cultural narratives sort of strip our ancestry of, from us in various ways, in terms of protests and, again, that war that we've been fighting all of this time. And then also how much more powerful it really is to show the messiness of it and to show where do you end up compromising that you didn't want to compromise? So what does it look like? And he made some mistakes too. And I don't think that the movie fails to point those out. That he has his own blind spots at one point. There's a whole thing where they had put together this incredible list of speakers and stuff for this march. And one of his people is there's not a single woman on this list. There's not a single, And so and I think that I don't know. It's good. I think it's good. I think people should watch it. It's not the most incredible movie I've ever seen, but I think it's really solid for what it is. And again, the performance, so good. Yeah.
Coleman Domingo's really been on a hot streak lately. He's quite an actor. And he's going to be in The Color Purple, right? Which he'll probably end up with an Oscar nomination this year. We'll see, I guess.
Critically, he was also the voice of Unicron in Transformers Rise of the Beasts.
It's one of those things. Everyone knows that's really what the Oscar nomination is for, but they have to attach it to a more appropriate seeming movie.
Exactly. And then we went to go see Saltburn, Which
oh yeah, I've been curious to hear your thoughts about this. I know you really were not a promising young woman fan, so.
I wasn't. It was one of my most hated movies of the year. I if you're interested in that, you can definitely hear us talk about it sometime last year. And I honestly, I knew almost nothing about this movie. I knew that Jacob Elordi was in it and Barry Keoghan. Keoghan? Is that how you pronounce it?
I think it's Keoghan, but I could be wrong about that. I don't know. Those Irish names are, they can be tough.
So I know they were both in it, and I knew there was like a gay vibes thing, and people had said something about a bathtub scene, and that was basically what I knew. I actually didn't realize it was Emerald Fennell until right before the movie when I was looking it up.
I've seen a lot of comparisons to Talented Mr. Ripley, which makes me interested because I really like that movie.
I think it is a lesser version of The Talented Mr. Ripley, unfortunately. I also like halfway through was like, oh, this is The Talented Mr. Ripley. I now understand where this is going. Great performance from Barry and Jacob. Jacob Elordi is one of those people who is so attractive and so magnetic that like it's not a big stretch to assume he's an awful person. Like it really doesn't seem possible that he could like look like that and like have those things and be a good person. But he isn't the villain here really. But he's great. And
Rosamund Pike? I think yes. That's a person. I didn't know she was in it.
She is. She was probably most famous for Gone Girl, but she also I watched her more recently because she plays one of the main characters in Wheel of Time. But there's a lot of fun stuff happening. Visuals are pretty. You can get some of the snappiness from, and it doesn't have. And the core story is so different from Promising Young Woman, which I think a lot of my issues with Promising Young Woman was really about the story and how I felt personally that she had handled it. Anyway, I believe what I talked about a lot last time was that I did not want to talk shit about people dealing with sexual assault in their own way, but I personally found it repellent. Anyway, but I did not feel that in Saltburn. Overall, like, it was fine. It definitely felt like it ran long. We were in the theater. It was a much more crowded theater than I expected. Like, it was solidly half full, almost entirely like college kids. And I don't know if that's because Jacob Elordi is in it and like a lot of girls. So like maybe that. So it was a very reactive crowd who clearly were not expecting what they had walked into. So like that's kind of fun. I'm not going to say much more about the bathtub scene. I didn't watch most of it. I did find it fairly gross, but I did find it extremely funny to be hearing the girls like scream. Why? I really enjoy a audience that is like reactive. In a thing that is not the movie's fault, something was beeping for almost the entire movie. There was just
a smoke alarm in the theater or something? Like,
but it was like beep, beep, beep. And I couldn't tell. It was quiet enough that I wasn't sure. It sounded like it was coming. I was in the back corner. It was quiet enough that I couldn't tell if like other people in the theater could hear it. The range, Morgan's hearing isn't great. And I wasn't clear if Morgan could hear it. And apparently they didn't hear it until like the last third of the movie, but it started in the trailers. I don't know what it was.
It sounds like the kind of thing you get with like a, you know, a door that hasn't closed all the way or a battery that needs to be changed or something like that. Interesting.
Yeah, so that's not the fault of the movie, but it was incredibly obnoxious. Also, apparently the girl next to Morgan or two seats down from Morgan was looking at Snapchat the entire time. And sometimes I couldn't see that from where I was, so I did not have that experience, but that wasn't great. No, I mean, it's fine. I don't know why I'd watch it again. I did really enjoy the performances. There were a few things that I found enjoyable, but it's not great. But on the other hand, when we're coming off of Promising Young Woman and my feelings on that, nowhere to go but up, really. So
this is interesting because this, to me, from what I've heard, this seems to be it seems like there's always one of these when it comes to like award season. There's always one like love it or hate it movie, and it's kind of like evenly divided. And that seems to be this movie this year. You're the first person I've heard say that it was okay. So
a lot of shock value scenes, a lot of Barry Keoghan being weird and creepy. And
I do really like him. He's
me too.
Compelling. I doubt I'll get to it in the theater. I think it's down to one show a day now. And we're in that time of year. There's a lot of stuff I want to see. I don't think I'll get to it, but I'm curious about it. I might get to it someday.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Yeah, you want to do movies and then we can talk TV. And then I have a book recommendation.
Fancy. Okay. So we talked about street scenes. last episode, I think I talked about having watched the first of the Wes Anderson shorts that he did for Netflix. I sat down and watched. I had been under the impression that they were all like just under an hour long, which is how long the first one was. But I sat down to start the second one and realized that the other three are like 20 minutes each. So I just watched all three of them. I really liked all three of them. The Ratcatcher has some really like, I think it's the closest to horror that Wes Anderson has ever gotten. There's some really interesting stuff. I think the third one, Poison, was probably my favorite. But they're all just kind of packed with like really clever, like stagecrafty kind of bits of production value and really like interesting, cool performances, by like the same cast in all of them, which is interesting. I was very impressed. I mean, I like Wes Anderson in general and I really enjoyed all of them. And I think as we said last time, Dev Patel really needs to be in more things, and I don't understand why Dev Patel isn't a huge movie star at this point, because he obviously deserves to be.
I assume it's the racism, but...
That's got to be a factor, right? Hopefully he'll still get there one of these days. I went to see The Holdovers, which you talked about last time and how much you loved it. I did really like it. I thought it was like maybe a little bit too long, like maybe like 10 or 15 minutes too long, but I am definitely kind of it's very much like a sort of, just sort of like a gentle, sad movie about lonely people finding each other, which is very much, you know, that is kind of my bag. I do tend to enjoy that kind of stuff. Paul Giamatti, who I haven't seen nearly enough of in recent years, it's like exactly his kind of wheelhouse, but I kind of assume the role was written for him, I guess, because he's worked with Alexander Payne before, right? He was in, what was it called? The Wine movie. What was that movie called?
I don't remember, but yes, he was in.
I have to Sideways. Yeah. Really good. You know, it is definitely like a holiday movie, which I guess I knew that from the trailer, but I hadn't really been thinking of it in those terms. But it's that without most of the sort of like overly sappy tone that you might expect would go along with that. I definitely recommend it. It is one that I will almost certainly watch again. Watched Planes, Trains, and Automobiles on Thanksgiving, because I know there are others, but that's the one like specifically Thanksgiving movie that I've like, honestly, I don't know that I've ever seen another one. I know there's a movie called Home for the Holidays that I guess is a Thanksgiving movie that I've heard is good, but I've never seen it. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is the one for me.
We briefly talked about watching it, but Mel really doesn't do well with angry men screaming a lot, so not a good movie for her.
there's a couple of like sort of central scenes that are there's a lot of that. Let's see, I watched Dial M for Murder, which has been one of my favorite Hitchcocks since I was a kid. It was one of the first ones I saw, and it's I recently bought it on Blu-ray, so I watched that one. It's a really cool, like, kind of like a backwards murder mystery where, like, the odd, you know exactly what happened the whole time and you're watching other people try to figure it out, which I always enjoy. It has an actor named Ray Milland as kind of the lead, as the sort of diabolical husband character, who was a big name back in the day. He was in a ton of stuff. But he looks so much like Jimmy Stewart in this movie. And I'm not familiar enough with any of his other stuff to know if he usually does or if Alfred Hitchcock just wanted him to be like an evil British Jimmy Stewart in this movie. Because obviously Jimmy Stewart worked with Hitchcock a lot. But it was funny. That had never occurred to me before. But I do love that movie. Definitely recommend that one to anyone who likes mystery kind of movies or Hitchcock thriller stuff. And then I went to see May December, which for some reason the Pickford Theater here in Bellingham was one of like 80 theaters in the country that was playing May December. I don't really know how that happened. I don't think it was even playing in Seattle. Maybe it was playing one place in Seattle or something, but it's out.
I think
on
it was because I think Al went to go see it. But we're going to watch it today on Netflix.
Yeah, I think it came out on Netflix yesterday or the day before or something. So it is easily available now. But it's really good. It's Todd Haynes, who we just talked about last time, because you watched Safe and I watched it a couple months ago and really liked it. And I realized after watching this and looking through his filmography that I've seen all of his features except for Wonderstruck. That's actually the only one of his movies that I haven't seen, which I was kind of surprised. I don't think of him as one of my favorites or anything. I just happen to have, he hasn't done that many.
I was gonna say, he hasn't done that movie many, and I feel like every time one releases, it's kind of an event type of movie that we go see. Like, I feel like he's like known as this like artistic director that there's a probability of Oscar nominations with, and so we go see them. I don't know.
Yeah, but I find that with a lot of his stuff, in fact, pretty much all of his stuff, I always enjoy them. I always, like, they're always interesting to me. I always appreciate them. I also always come out of them feeling like there's a level to them that I didn't get. And in a lot of cases, I come out of it feeling like, I think in most of his movies, I've had a couple of moments during them where I have the thought, like, wait a minute, is this a comedy? Like, does he think of this as a, like, did he intend this to be a comedy on some level that I'm not totally getting? And I had that a couple times with May December, but I've also seen that, like, seeing other people write about the movie, I've seen other people talk about his work in those terms, and I feel like I'm not in on the joke on whatever that is. So that's not the movie's fault. That's me. But I did really like it. I mean, the performances are great. Obviously, Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore are both fantastic. It's not specifically based on a true story, but it's clearly inspired by Mary Kay Letourneau and.
I was going to say, I've seen a lot of Mary Kay Letourneau clips going around.
There's one in particular that they kind of took some of they took some dialogue in the movie straight from like an interview that, yeah. I can't remember the guy's name. That
is Dylan something?
Maybe. I don't remember. At any rate, it's kind of based on that. She wasn't a teacher in this movie, but the guy, the actor who plays her husband, is named Charles Melton, and I had never seen him before. He's been in a few things in the last few years. I guess he was in the new Bad Boys movie, a few other things, but I was not familiar with him. But he's really fucking good. Like, he's definitely in the, like, he's probably going to get a Best Supporting Actor nomination for it. And there's so a lot of really good performances. Todd Haynes is also very much like. He's clearly inspired a lot by like classic Hollywood melodrama kind of stuff. So there's a lot of like music cues and stuff that come off as almost goofy. And I feel like I can't tell if that's the intention or not. This adds to my thing of like, maybe this is meant to be kind of funny and like awkwardly funny. I don't know. I should probably read more about him and his stuff. Cause I'm always interested in it. I always like it, but I always feel like I'm a little bit on the outside looking in with it. But it's a good movie that you'll probably hear a lot about in the next few months because it'll probably get a lot of awards attention. And then the other night I went to see Godzilla Minus One. Have you been hearing about Godzilla Minus One?
I've been seeing there's a lot of buzz. I haven't seen it.
I had barely heard anything about it before it came out, but it is not a continuation of the Godzilla Kong thing that Hollywood has been doing. It's a Japanese movie that got a lot of attention there and ended up getting, I suspect partially just because it is a little bit of a thin slate this year. A lot of the big movies got pushed. It got like a full theatrical release here, including like IMAX screens and stuff like that, which is really uncommon for this kind of thing. But I'd been hearing it was really good, and like I've only ever seen one of the Japanese Godzilla movies. I saw the original 50s one. That's the only one I've ever watched, but I've always been kind of curious about them. And so we went to see this one, and it's really good. It's a lot of fun. It's set like, it's basically, I didn't really realize this, but it's basically a prequel to the 50s Godzilla, right? It's a minus one, and then you have one, and yeah. So it is set like in the immediate aftermath of World War II. It actually starts. The opening scene is in the last days of the war. And it follows this guy who had been like a, he had been given the task of being a kamikaze pilot in the last days of the war, and he essentially chickened out and didn't do it. So then he comes back home after the war is over, and his whole neighborhood of Tokyo has been destroyed, and his parents are dead, and he's like living in the ruins of the city that he grew up in. And then Godzilla attacks. So it actually has like a surprisingly solid like character storyline, emotional core to it that mostly really works. And the Godzilla stuff is all really cool. It's Godzilla is fully CG in this one, which I guess is the first time a Japanese movie has done that. They have stuck with the guy in a suit thing up until now, is my understanding. But it all looks great. I mean, the effects all look great. They made the decision to keep the sort of like awkward upright posture that Godzilla always had as a result of it being a dude in a suit, rather than like the sort of more like forward leaning, like T-Rex profile that he usually has in the American ones, which I thought was kind of a cool choice, even if it is kind of awkward looking. But, this is definitely not the Godzilla of the American movies, where he's like kind of an ally to humanity. He's a scary monster in this one. But really well done. It's a really cool movie. I definitely recommend it, and I definitely recommend going to see it on a big screen if you can. I don't know how long it's going to be playing in theaters here, but it's really good.
Okay.
And then last thing, I finally got around to watching, speaking of David Fincher, finally got around to watching The Killer on Netflix.
I think we are also watching that today.
I'm curious to know what you'll think of it. I had heard very mixed things and wasn't quite sure what to expect. And I also really didn't care for his last movie, the
Gary Oldman.
Yeah, Mank. I thought Mank was boring as hell. Like, it's the only...
Me too.
I don't love all of Fincher's movies, although I like him a lot more than you do, but I had definitely never seen him do anything that I thought was boring before. It's like I genuinely didn't think he was capable of that. But Mank was quite boring to me. I know a lot of people liked it, but at any rate, so The Killer is... I'm still not totally sure how to feel about The Killer, because it's... I guess, if you're going to watch it soon, or you haven't seen it yet, I don't want to get too into it, but it's... in terms of the plot of the movie, it is very like straightforward to the point of being kind of boring. Like there's no mystery, there's no plot twists. It's just like point to point to point. It's you know, I don't know. It was not what I was expecting in that regard. Fassbender's good, but there's all of the stuff that's interesting that I'm not quite sure how I felt about it is, you know, stuff to do with his character that I don't want to get into if you haven't watched it yet. So we'll talk about it more next time probably. But, I think I'll have to watch it again at some point to really kind of nail down my feelings on it. But I didn't love it as much as I was, nearly as much as I was hoping to. It's definitely not going to end up on my best of the year or anything. And I'm disappointed that he is doing his stuff exclusively on Netflix now, and none of it's getting... It got like a tiny theatrical release. I think Netflix does that with all their big movies now because they got to do the awards qualifier stuff. But it definitely didn't play here. You know, I wish he wasn't doing that, and I don't really understand why he is. So that was my last movie.
Okay.
So how much TV stuff have you got?
Just a few things. Have you been watching A Murder at the End of the World?
I haven't, but I thought it looked kind of interesting, and then I found out it was what's her name? I can never remember her name, but
Brit Marling.
Yeah, she's always interesting. So it's on my list, but I'm behind on TV stuff, so I haven't gotten around to it, but I'm planning on it.
Yeah, Morgan and I started watching. Yeah, it's Brit Marling is the, you know, co-writer director with Zalba Manglish. I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
The same guy that they've been working together a lot, right?
Yes. And it also has Clive Owen in it and some other folks as well that you might recognize. I think we're 3 or 4 episodes in out of... I think we're 4 out of 10 at this point. So I'm not going to say a ton about it. But so far, it's definitely really enjoyable. It's been an interesting kind of cool little story. So, and apparently some of the tech stuff is ridiculous, but it has not made Morgan want to throw himself out a window as often as sometimes tech stuff does. So, but yeah, it's good. It's up on Hulu. We started season two of Loki, which we're two episodes into, so a third of the way in. I don't know. Remains to be seen how I feel about the whole season, but it's fine so far. And then on Friday, me and Eric and Morgan started the Monarch show and watched the first couple episodes of that.
That's also on my list. I haven't got to that yet either.
I'm enjoying it so far. I think it's pretty fun. So far, we've got two episodes and you get like one major monster appearance in each one, which I'm sure is ludicrously expensive. So there. but so far, I've been having a pretty good time with it. I feel like it's been, I'm not like, I want to watch the rest. So, you know, there's that. Yeah, other than that, it's just the usual. I've been watching The Golden Bachelor and Bob's Burgers and, you know, all of that, but nothing too thrilling. What have you been watching?
So I don't have a whole lot. I have been working, I don't think I talked about this last time, I've been working my way through the last season of Better Call Saul. I think I have two episodes left. I was really hoping to finish it before we got to this, but I haven't. I am one of the people who thinks Better Call Saul is probably a better show than Breaking Bad, even though I really loved Breaking Bad. I'm very on board with Better Call Saul. It's really fucking good. And the last season's been great so far. I really don't have any or very, very few complaints. But I'm not quite done with it yet. I'm still working. Last time I talked about that Scavenger's Reign, the animated sci-fi thing on HBO. I've got a few episodes of that left, and that's still really fucking good. I think the only thing that I have finished since the last time we recorded that I think I forgot to mention last time. Have you watched the Goosebumps series on Hulu?
I have not.
I thought it might be something you would watch because it seems like the kind of thing you usually lean towards.
I did look at it and I really did enjoy the Goosebumps movie, the first one. I liked that one a lot. I think I've been very like horror averse this year, so I feel like I just didn't end up doing it. But I did look at it. I did consider it. I'm sort of interested. Is it good?
I enjoyed it. Yeah. It's basically exactly what I was hoping it would be. It's like, you know, sort of, it's very like a tween horror kind of, you know, most of the characters are high schoolers. It's, you know, it's not particularly like scary or gruesome or anything, but it's fun. Most of the kids are pretty good. It has, what's his name?
Justin Long?
Justin Long. Right. Justin Long is in, he's kind of he's probably the best known face in it. But he's fun. He gets to do some fun stuff in this. He's like possessed for part of it, and so he's good. It's all pretty silly. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff with a haunted ventriloquist dummy, which is like, you know, well-trod territory. That's, you know, but it's fun. I enjoyed it. It looks like they're gonna do more probably. There were a couple episodes that actually specifically had me thinking of like older, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like,
that's what I thought of with the ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah, well, right. That's true. There's an episode with worms that specifically reminded me of that one character in Buffy the Vampire Slayer that was like, I don't, it's been a long time since I've watched that, but you know who I'm talking about.
You.
Yeah. It also did a thing that I have not seen in streaming shows at all, and I'm not, it had commercial cuts. Like, it had edits that were clearly, they were like what you would have seen in an old TV show where it like cuts at a climactic point and goes to black and then comes back to it. But Hulu now has tiers with ads, right? So I wonder if they are now cutting their new shows to do that. I'm gonna be watching on other new stuff to see if this is a continuing thing.
Yeah, I bet, but they are, because I
probably really... But it, like, to me, I think it actually kind of adds to it. Like, I'm glad I don't have to watch the ads, but I feel like having those cuts there kind of adds to the tension. At least in this show, I think it's done, you know, it's the kind of thing that could be done badly, obviously, but I don't know. It added to the sort of like fun old school feel of the show for me. So yeah, I enjoyed it. I recommend it. It was fun.
Nice.
I think that's the only TV stuff that I've really been doing. So,
Are you going to watch the Percy Jackson show when it comes out?
I think so, yeah, because May and I have read a few of those books. I think we've read the first three and really enjoy them.
They get so much better as the kids get older. I just read his most recent one, and it's...
Are they still going?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they don't... He releases them in, like, trilogies. So, like, there is the first trilogy that is the Percy Jackson and whatever when he's, like, 12 or whatever. There are other trilogies with Percy Jackson. They overlap with, like, because Percy is... Greek, is Roman mythology, right?
I knew he had a related series. Like, there's an Egyptian one, right? And, like... I knew he had that stuff, but...
There is overlap sometimes from, like, the Egyptians. All of those are very good, by the way. I really liked the Egyptian ones, and I really liked the Norse god ones. Part of what is fun as he progresses is that you can see him learning things. So we get more queer characters as the books progress. We get more people of color explicitly. We get more, like, a lot of different things that are very cool that you can really see him, like, progressing and learning things as a writer. But also, so there are, I think, three different trilogies, and then this one just started, that include Percy. Like, that are, like, so there's one with a main character from Greek mythology, where there's, that whole trilogy involves all of our main, so we have trilogies that include Percy and Annabeth, and then we have, so, like, the book that he put out earlier this year that he co-wrote, that was about Nico, and you've met Nico in the first ones, the son of Hades, who is gay, and that comes out a little later in the series, but and it's him and his boyfriend, and the entire book is just focused on, it was the first time he did, like, main characters, and he co-wrote it with a queer author.
I had no idea this was all that, like, I knew that he had other series set kind of around different mythologies, but I didn't realize they were actually specifically related, and I didn't, like, I think we have six Percy Jackson books on the shelf at home, but I think we've only read the first three, but I didn't know any of this about it being published in blocks like this and stuff.
Yeah, they're published in, like, trilogy sets. So, like, the one he just released is the first series he's done starring Percy in a while, and Percy and Annabeth. And it's kind of fun. He's moved to it's going to be a trilogy. This is the first one. He's like 17 now, and he's getting ready to go to college, and he has to get letters of recommendation from doing different quests for the gods. It's fun to watch how he plays with that and stuff, and as the characters age up. I am dying for someone besides me to have read most of the Percy Jackson books that I know, or most of the Riordan series, because I love them so much but have, like, no one to talk to about them. And some of them haven't overlapped as much, and sometimes there's like short story collections that are released sometimes that are sort of interstitial material. Like, Annabeth has met one of the main female characters from the Egyptian series, but it was in a short story one. It's not direct. It hasn't directly. So they all exist in the same world. There are, like, reasons why they don't see each other's stuff. And they overlap in really interesting ways. They're really good.
See, that's kind of a relief to me, because one of my main complaints about the Percy Jackson ones that we've been reading so far is that they're constantly talking about they're constantly talking about Western civilization as this, like, central important thing that they need to save. And it's always felt a little tone deaf and not great to me. Like, I don't really have any other complaints along those lines about the books so far, but the language that they use to refer to the importance of the legacy of Western civilization has always felt suspicious to me. So I'm glad to hear that it is actually pretty expansive outside of that.
Well, and again, I think you'll find that you see him learning. You know, he wrote those first books 20 years ago, and he really has, like, he really listens when people give him feedback on stuff. So, like, the Egyptian ones and the Norse ones he wrote himself, but then he's also done this Rick Riordan Presents, because, like, at this point he's, like, the top YA author in the world. And so he found people to write within their own culture about their own thing. So I've read a few of those that have been really good. And of course, by putting his name on them, and he, like, helps edit and stuff, I think, like that. But, like, but yeah, I think I'm always, like, it's such a big undertaking because there's so many of them. And I really feel like, although I feel like the first ones are enjoyable and a fun time, I feel like they really pick up steam as they go. But, like, it's a big ask to be like, but if you get through, like, 6 or 10 of these books, even YA, but no, they're great. And I'm so excited about the TV show. I'm really, really excited.
Yeah, that starts later this month, right? Or in January or something?
It's December 16th.
Yeah, no, we are definitely planning on watching that one. Yeah.
So that'll be cool. And then the only other thing I wanted to talk about real quick was a book that I just read called The Free People's Village by Sim Kern. I randomly ran across this book because I ran across their TikTok promoting it, and it was, and I was like, yeah, all right, the cover's cool, like it's a queer person, right? Like, you know, sure, why not? And the library had a Kindle copy of it, so I put it on hold. It was great. I'm like giving it as gifts to multiple people. It's set in a slightly, mostly takes place around like 2019 to 2020. It's set in a slightly alternate reality where Al Gore won the election instead of George Bush and immediately started like a very intense war on climate change thing. But what that actually looked like in practice was that there were like a lot of carbon credits and like taxes and like all of these kind of things. So like rich people can just pay them off and do whatever they want. And poor people are getting progressively, you know, they can't eat meat and they can't drive cars and they can't do all of these things, all of which feels correct. And it ends up really focusing on this like young white girl who is first, like, she's a teacher and she's like first come into these spaces for various reasons. I won't give like too much of it away, but and ends up with all of these activists. Again, this has really been a theme unexpectedly of like this very messy and people like arguing about like, you know, is peaceful protest the way to go? No way. And like, I don't think the book like necessarily, like, it's not so simplistic as to like take a side and be like one of these is best. It's like, this is very challenging. This is hard shit. And they end up doing like an occupation of like an area. And like, again, as someone who first started learning about a lot of social justice stuff as identifying as a young woman at the time, I really resonated and recognized a lot of Maddie's like thoughts as she's like, you know, feeling like a coward because she ran when the tear gas started, and like she's, you know, is she taking up too much space in the room, is this, you know, makes all of these mistakes. It's a really great book though. It's really I think it deals with a lot of complicated things in really smart and interesting ways. There's a main character who uses Z's, M's or pronouns, which is great because I need practice with neo pronouns. It's fantastic, and I just, more people should read it. It's, you know, they're just this like little independent author, and I'm just so glad I read it, so I want to toss it out there for our, you know, whole five listeners that they should also read it. So that's my two cents there.
is it a thing you can buy in bookstores? Is it a, okay,
yeah. Yeah, no, it's up on Amazon or wherever, I'm sure. You know, it's like $20 or something for the hardcover, or you can get a Kindle for 10 or 15. Yeah, so I super recommend it. It's really good, and it's a really like it talks about a lot of complicated topics, but it never feels like slowed. Like, it's a really propulsive like plot. I feel like it never feels like slowed down in that, but it still manages to cover things in a really interesting way. So I just wanted to recommend that. Okay, well, we don't know when we'll be back next for sure, but probably either by the end of the year or right after the end of the year. So
yeah, I guess I think Christmas and New Year's Day both fall on Sundays. So it doesn't seem very likely that, well, certainly not on Christmas. So yeah, could be a little while before we get another one in the can, but we'll see.
We'll do what we can. Anyway, next time we'll talk about Winterlight. Huzzah!
Okay, bye everyone.
Bye!